on this episode of Rebel Spirit Radio.
According to these philosophies, most people are unhappy most of the time. So it is a means by which we can reduce the unhappiness during our lifetime and also prevent the future. But this is the whole approach. At the same time, they are not trying to find out some means by which you can overcome these difficulties, but they want to go to the root of the truth about the universe, truth about the individual self. So with knowing the truth, they say it is possible for us to overcome the grief, because the truth is so satisfying, so great, that we need not suffer like this the way we are suffering. That's their goal. They are not merely offering you some palliatives by which you will be able to overcome the grief. But they say, if you know the truth about these things, about your own self, right, then it will be possible for everybody to not to suffer the way people are suffering.
Welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio, exploring the frontiers of spirituality, consciousness, the esoteric, in humanity's sacred relationship with a living earth.
I'm your host, Nick Mather, and in this episode, I welcome Srivatsa Ramaswamy to the show to discuss his book, Samkhya Karika, A Yoga Practitioner's Guide to Overcoming the Three Causes of Suffering. The discussion covers the relationship between Samkhya philosophy and yoga, exploring concepts like Purusha, Prakriti, and the Three Gunas. Ramaswamy emphasizes the philosophical underpinnings of Samkhya and yoga, drawing comparisons with modern science to make the ancient teachings more accessible to contemporary practitioners. Also, please be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on whatever platform you use to listen to or view podcasts. Your support is truly appreciated. Srivatsa Ramaswamy studied with Sri Krishnamacharya in India for 33 years. From 1955 until Krishnamacharya's passing in 1987 at the age of 100. Srivatsa Ramaswamy taught yoga in universities, hospitals, and schools in India for more than 20 years, and was a visiting faculty at Loyola Marymount University in Los Angeles for 15 years. He is the author of many articles and 4 books, including Yoga for the 3 Stages of Life. He joins me today to discuss his latest book, Samkhya Karika, A Yoga Practitioner's Guide to Overcoming the 3 Causes of Suffering. Srivatsa, welcome to Rebel Spirit Radio.
Yes, thank you for the...
Let's begin with a short
Om Indukaratanai Anaimukhatanai Indinilam Pirai Pondai Eitrinai Nandimakandanai Jnanakolundinai Pundiyil Vaithadi Potruhindrene Om. Yes.
All right, thank you. Can you say what that was?
It's a translation. Ganesha. Ganesha is the elephant-faced deity, mm-hmm. which we normally, any activity we start, we say a prayer to Ganesha. This prayer is in my mother tongue, called Tamil, right? It's not in Sanskrit. It's my mother tongue. Right?
Oh, okay. Tamil, is that correct?
Yeah, Tamil, yes. Tamil, it's a South Indian language.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Yes, I have a small little altar to Ganesh over here that I like to make offerings to on occasion. So we're going to talk about the book, Samkhya Karika. And this is a translation of a text. And it was written by a 4th century sage, Ishvara Krishna. And then there's commentary by a 6th century Vedic philosopher, Gaudapada. And I thought that the place for us to begin would be to talk about Samkhya and its place in Indian philosophy, because I don't know how many people in my audience or in the West in general are all that familiar with Samkhya philosophy. And I know that in India, there's traditionally the 6 schools or 6 darshanas, as they're referred to. So yes. If you could say a little bit about Samkhya and perhaps its relation to yoga, because I know it's always paired with yoga.
Okay. Yes. Many of you are familiar with the Vedas. You know, Vedas are the basic, scriptures in India. And then Vedas contain a large portion on prayers to various gods, small gods. It also contains a number of portion on the rituals, making offerings to the gods called Yajna. And then there is another portion called the Upanishads, the philosophy portion, the Vedanta portion. And then there are in the the philosophical point of view, there are six philosophies called darshanas. Darshanas means expositions. Six darshanas are there, out of which three are called Nivritti Shastra. Nivritti Shastras means their main goal is to remove the pain and unhappiness in human beings, and also prevent future birth. According to these philosophies, they all believe in karma theory. They all believe in karma theory. So whatever activities that we do, some of it gets fructified during this particular lifetime. Rest are carried over to the next, depending upon the karma bundle which is dominant. It's a fairly well developed philosophy called. So these three philosophies subscribe to the view, to the philosophy of, the karma theory. So their goal, all the three, their goal is to find out ways and means by which you can avoid the future birth. According to them, this birth itself, according to these philosophies, most people are unhappy most of the time. So it is a means by which you can reduce the unhappiness during our lifetime and also prevent the future birth. This is the whole approach. At the same time, they are not trying to find out some means by which you can overcome these difficulties, but they want to go to the root of the, the truth about the universe, truth about the individual self. So with knowing the truth, they say it is possible for us to overcome the grief, because the truth is so satisfying, so great, that we need not suffer like this the way we are suffering. That's their goal. They are not merely offering you some palliatives by which you will be able to overcome the grief. They say, if you know the truth about these things, about your own self, right, then it will be possible for everybody to not to suffer the way people are suffering. So they want to remove the ignorance of what constitutes the real self, because the real self, according to them, is absolutely great, pure, non-changing consciousness. It is immortal. So with that in view, they try to give means by which you will be able to achieve this particular goal. So Sankhya, of the three philosophies, Sankhya is the first philosophy that came out with the truth about the nature of one's own self. According to them, the real self, not the physical body, the real self is said to be non-changing, pure consciousness. They call it as Purusha, Jnaha, Atman, so many different terms, depending upon the context. See, this Purusha is my intellect, my analyzing capability. I have got that faculty. If that faculty is able to understand the true nature of the self, then it will be able to stay with that, and then overcome the wrong feeling that the body mind complex is the real self. So this is their main approach, Sankhya's main approach. And at the same time, they very logically explain the evolution of the universe itself. So with that, they say that everything that you have got to know so that you will be able to live comfortably for the rest of the life and also avoid a future life. So this is the main purpose of Sankhya. The meaning of the word Sankhya is Samyak Khyapayati Iti Sankhya. Samyak means thoroughly. Khyapayati means something which is able to completely explain everything, including the origin of the universe, the evolution itself, and the true nature of the self. All these three are said to be beautifully enunciated in this philosophy. And Sankhya Karika is said to be one of the best treatises or texts which explains the Sankhya philosophy in a very logical way. The Sankhya author, Ishwara Krishna, is said to be not only a scholar, and also a great poet. So even many Sanskrit scholars call the Sankhya Karika as a Sanskrit classic itself. So as a literature, it's great. And the philosophical content also absolutely great. So many people, at least in the olden days, they used to pay a lot of respect to Sankhya philosophy. And then in the olden days, anybody who wants to talk about the Indian philosophy must have a very good grounding on the Sankhya philosophy. Without that, the other philosophies will not be easily accessible.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for that. The Indian philosophy is very interesting, especially the Vedanta, what comes after. And I just a real quick question on the title, the Karika. I know that in terms of the literature, right? We have the Vedas, which you mentioned, and then there's the kind of the Vedanta, which I always saw as the or learned as like the end of the Vedas, but I believe in the book you refer to them as the culmination of the Vedas.
I couldn't hear well. Can you a little louder, please, if you don't mind?
Yes, yeah, sorry. But in the I'll kind of repeat what I was just saying. In terms of the Indian philosophical literature, we've got the Vedas, which are the source
Yeah.
of a lot, and then there is Vedanta, which I always understood or learned as the end of the Vedas. In the
Right.
book, you mentioned, I think you referred to them as the culmination of the Vedas.
Yes.
And this would be things like the Upanishads.
Right.
And then there's other writings that come out, like the Aranyakas, and I never know if I'm pronouncing the Puranas right. And you get other kind of traditions like the Patanjali's Yoga Sutras.
Right.
And so I'm curious in terms of Karika, because that's referring to a kind of text. I think that we would consider this part of Vedanta, part of that culmination of the Vedas. I hope I'm right with that. But I'm kind of curious what its position is in terms of, for example, how is it different than what we would refer to as like the sutras, like the Yoga Sutras? How is a Karika different than that?
No, see, Karika is said to be, I mean, Karika means an exposition, right? As an exposition. So Sankhya Karika, the Sankhya philosophy is there, and the Sankhya philosophy is explained thoroughly by Karika. There are Karika is a special form of writing, that's about all. There is nothing unique about this, except that the literally speaking, it is a different way of writing. There are two great Karikas. One is Sankhya Karika, the other one is called Mandukya Karika, written by Shankaracharya's guru. So these are the two well-known Karikas there. But it is, as a Karika only means that it is a very particular thorough exposition of the philosophy, right? And you were mentioning about Yoga Sutra. So, Yoga Sutra is written in a different type of language, I mean, different type of formation. It is called Sutra. There are certain rules in writing. So sutras have a minimum number of words, right? They will dispense with verbs. There are no verbs in the sutras. So the whole idea is because in the olden days, most of the Vedas were not written. They had to be heard from your teacher, memorized, and then passed on to the next generation. So there's some what do you call some people wanted to what do you call it, simply zip the whole thing. You condense it by removing unnecessary thing. And then later on, with the sutra, there are other people who write a detailed commentary on sutras. So Patanjali wrote it in a sutra form. Sankhya Karika is written in the Karika form in the form of shlokas. But at the same time, even though it is written in the form of shlokas, it is also very condensed. Very condensed. Every word is very what do you call has got a meaning. You can't replace it with another word. That kind of a literary work Sankhya Karika is, right?
Okay, thank you. That actually helps quite a bit. One of the terms that you use, I'm just kind of I since I teach too, it's I always want to make sure that everyone's kind of clear on terminology. But the slokas is
Yes.
kind of the verse that
Right.
these are. So the and I just wanted to clarify. So in the book here, you've got the slokas, and I think there's 72. Is that
Yes,
right? I think,
72 slokas. Yes.
72 slokas. There's the script, the Devanagari, and then you break down, and this is really helpful, the Sanskrit terms, and then there's a sort of a translation, I think,
Right.
of the actual sloka, and then there's the commentary.
Yes.
Is and the question I had is that commentary Is that your commentary, or is that a translation of Ishvara Krishna's commentary?
No, Ishvara Krishna wrote the shlokas. He didn't write the
Okay.
commentary. So
Okay.
there were there were a number of well-known Sanskrit scholars some 400, 600 years back, like Gaudapada, Vachaswati
Okay.
Mishra. They all wrote commentaries on in Sanskrit. They are
Okay.
available. Modern times, many people have written commentaries on in English or other languages. But the reason why I wrote this is it is mainly. Nowadays, many people are now studying Yoga Sutras. Number of Yoga students are studying Yoga Sutras. But then, Yoga Sutras leave a lot of gaps. Not that they are not done, what do you call, purposely, because it is already well known. Where do you find them? You find them in Sankhya. So Sankhya and Yoga, they go hand in hand. So
Right.
Sankhya gives you the theoretical basis, whereas Yoga gives you the practical means by which you are able to realize what is contained in the Sankhya-karika. So they both go hand in hand. So even though people study Yoga Sutras, there are certain things that they are not able to really appreciate. So in the old days, my teacher, after he taught me the Yoga Sutras, he said, you must study Sankhya-karika so that you will have a much better understanding of Yoga Sutras. So from that point of view, people who study Yoga Sutras, of course, Sankhya-karika can be studied as a standalone text. We can do that. But then, this was purposely, I wrote this book purposely for people who study yoga students who have studied Yoga Sutras, right? So what I did was, even so many, if you go through the general commentaries that are available, they are based on the Gaudapada commentary or whatever I told you. They take it from that and they write it. But here, what I want to do was, I want to compare it with the Yoga Sutras, so that people be able to understand the Yoga Sutras better by studying this. So this is one purpose. And another thing is, you see, I wanted to make use of terms and arguments so that modern people can understand. There's no point in repeating whatever has been said 400, 500 years back, where many things are taken for granted. Now, people, for instance, in the olden days, they will say the Atman or the Purusha is pure non-changing consciousness. People will accept it in the old days. Nowadays, people ask the question, how do you say that? So I have to explain this. So what I have done is, this is again based on what I learned from my guru, right? So I tried to make it accessible for modern yoga practitioners so that they can understand this better. The ideas are still the same as contained in the old thing. Only thing is, I wrote it in such a way that modern people will be. So I tried to compare. Okay, for instance, I tried to compare the what do you call. In Yoga Sutras, we use the term Chitta Vritti. Chitta Vritti is what is Chitta Vritti. Many people translate in so many ways. Chitta Vritti is one kind of Chitta Vritti is what, supposing I'm looking at the computer in front of me, light particles go through my eyes, hit the retina, and goes to the brain. Brain converts them into images, and it is where everything is seen, even according to science. They say that my brain converts everything into an image in the, what do you call, in the visual cortex. So it is still in the mind. The same idea you find in the Yoga Sutras also, right? So the whole idea is, and then they say that whatever is seen in the mind, in the chitta, is Chitta Vritti, then that becomes the object, which is the one that is seeing this constantly. The Chitta Vritti is keep on changing, whereas the entity that is able to observe whatever is going on in Chitta Vritti is called the Purusha, is the real self. That is what it says. Now, Sankhya-karika explained this in a much greater detail. So I tried to bring the both of them together so that people. There is a purpose of writing this book, not merely another translation of Sankhya-karika. Many people have already done that. I wanted to make this book, what you call, more and more useful for yoga people so that they'll be able to understand the yoga concept much better.
And I've done this in my teachings. I had told you in our email conversations that many years ago I did a paper on Samkhya and yoga. So I had a little bit of a background. And I found your book really helpful to elucidate some of the
Right.
information that I did not have at the time, because I was reading more, modern commentaries and explanations. But let's take a step back and look at the philosophy, look at the cosmology that's presented in Samkhya. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to give you my version of it, and you can correct me and let me know where I'm right and where I am incorrect. So my understanding is Samkhya and yoga here, it's dualistic in the sense that there is Purusha, which is that pure consciousness, and then there's Prakriti. And Prakriti, I think, is often translated as nature. I often think of it as the material stuff. And then, and this is one of the questions is, how does all of this, how do these two things start working together? The way that I understood it is that Purusha, the analogy is that Purusha is almost like a flashlight, that it turns its attention to the Prakriti, and that sort of wakes up the Prakriti. It excites it, if you will. And there are these three gunas, three qualities that are inherent in Prakriti. And that's the sattva, rajas and tamas. And then out of those, and we can talk a little bit about what those represent, you get these sort of evolutes of buddhi, which is intellect, the ahamkara, which is the ego, and then manas, which is mind. And we have this mistaken perception, it seems, that we are just Prakriti. And I find it fascinating that mind and intellect aren't seen as part of Purusha, but they're part of the Prakriti. And the goal is to realize that what we are is Purusha, that we are the unchanging, immortal consciousness. So I'm going to stop there and let you correct me and affirm anything that I got correct.
No, I mean, what you said is perfectly correct. Only thing, I will probably put it in a slightly different way. The whole life, whole life, I am the subject, the rest of the world is the object, right? I am the subject, the rest of the world is the object. Okay, so we go about our life, and that cannot be changed, so all through my life, I am the subject. Now, the question that they are asking is, the question is, I am the subject, the outside world is the object. Now, I am aware of the outside world, but I am aware of not only the outside world, I am aware also of my me. I am aware of me right at this particular moment. I am aware of the computer in front of me and the other things around me, but I am also aware of this individual, this Ramaswamy sitting here and talking, right? So the entity that is aware of everything, including the outside world and this person, is said to be the what you call Purusha. That is the subject. What is the essential nature of a subject? The essential nature of a subject is to be aware of the object, right? Mm-hmm. What is the object now? The object is not only the outside world, but also that includes this person. Because the universe consists of not only the outside world, but also this person as part of the universe, right? So the entity that is able to, what you call, to experience everything, the entire universe, my universe, right? Not everybody's universe. My universe consists of all the objects outside, and also this individual as part of this universe. That, what you call, the entity that is aware of it is the subject. And that should be called as I. So there, what is the essential nature of a subject? It should be aware of the object. What is the object? According to Patanjali Yoga Sutra, even though outside objects are there, they are reduced to chittavritti. My own body, I am aware of my own body, that is also reduced to chittavritti, called asmitavritti. And all of them put together, there is a total presentation, and that is only being observed. We don't really observe the outside world. So Patanjali in the Yoga Sutras reduces the subject-object relationship into the non-changing consciousness of the subject, and then the mental projection of everything that we receive as the object. So in Sankhya, this is not explicitly said, but where in Patanjali's Yoga Sutras, subject-object relations beautifully lichotomized. Subject is the non-changing consciousness, and what is object? Object is only Chittavritti, because everything is reduced to Chittavritti in, even according to science, everything is reduced to what you call a mental projection in the visual cortex or whatever it be, complicated process, right? So what Patanjali would say is, what we got to deal with only the Chittavrittis, right? Because everything is reduced to Chitta, deal with that. Once you deal with that, then the pure consciousness will be free, it will not be bothered by the vagaries of the outside world or vagaries of my own this body also. So this is a slightly different way of looking at the whole thing. But that is, this becomes possible only if you are able to combine both Sankhya and Yoga Sutras together. Sankhya-karika talks about three things to be known. One, the non-changing pure consciousness as a self. Then the what you call the Mula Prakriti from which the entire universe came, and then the various stages in which the evolution took place, right? All these things are related. Ultimately, they also say that the main goal of Sankhya, the main goal of Yoga, the main goal of Vedanta is to understand what constitutes the self. What constitutes the once I understand, I mean my buddhi, my analyzing capability, my intellect, if it is able to understand that the non-changing consciousness is the real self and not the body mind, what you call body mind complexes. When it is able to do that, then the goal of both Sankhya, Yoga, and Vedanta are achieved.
Okay. So, one of the questions that I have, and this was one of the, I guess, a little bit of a criticism that I had because it didn't seem to answer the question for me. Not what you just said, but I'm referring to the book. So even stepping back further, because you mentioned the kind of the creation of the universe, right? And you in the book, so we have Mula Prakriti, which is the original source of the universe. And it's the absolute source of the evolved universe, which is manifest, or excuse me, unmanifest. And it says it exists, but we cannot say where it exists. And then there is also this universal or cosmic intelligence. And the question that I had was in the text, where there was a few instances where there were questions and answers. And one of the questions was, where does Purusha come from? And in the answer, I didn't think that it really answered that question so much, where it comes from. And is it just this? And I'm not sure if, Purusha is connected to this universal cosmic intelligence. Is it just self-existent? Is it something that we just can't answer? Where did that come from?
I mean, let's go by what Sankhya-karika, the Ishwara Krishna says. He has got three things, right? One is the Purusha or Jnaha, there is the term Jnaha, the knower or experiencer. Then the Mula Prakriti, and then the what you call the other 23 evolutions, the whole thing, right? Now, the question, in fact, I was a bit what you call it, very a bit unhappy about the question itself, because this has been dealt with in the beginning itself. In the beginning of Sankhya-karika, what you call it? So far, Purusha is concerned, Purusha, na prakriti, na vikriti, Purusha. That's what the third shloka or somewhere says. What does it say? The Purusha is neither an evolute nor does it produce anything. So, something which does not produce anything or doesn't come from anything else is non-changing, it is immortal. So, that idea has already been given. Now he was asking the question, where does it come from? Where does it come from? Because, and then we'll have to see that the evolution of Mula Prakriti into the various evolutes, one of the evolutes is space, right? One of the evolutes is space. That is, from Mula Prakriti, then the Mahatattva, the universal cosmic intelligence, then Ahankara, the what you call it, the universal energy, then the five tanmatras, five sensations, then the five bhutas, hence includes space, Akasha. So the question is, Akasha belongs to Prakriti and Purusha has already been said to be not belonging to this. So when we say, then for this, the question, where from where did Purusha come? Because there is, it is not, does not belong to space at all. Right at this particular moment, right? Just think of it. Right at this particular moment, as I'm talking, there is an awareness of me talking to you, all these things in the universe. And which is the one that is observing? That is a Purusha. Where is it? No, you can't define it, because you can't say it is here in my heart or in my head. No, because you are trying to say that Purusha is in space. But space itself is an evolute of Prakriti. Am I clear? Yes. So the question itself is wrong. The question was wrong. Where did it come from? That question is wrong, because we are used to thinking that everything should come from some space. But in this case, that is where the difference comes, because every space itself is something which is experienced. Space is something, and which is the one that is experiencing space? That is the Purusha. So Purusha does not come from any place. It is by itself. It is, it is independent, absolutely independent, unconnected with anything else. So that is the answer for this particular question. So to explain that, I took the trouble to re-emphasize the nature of the Purusha. That is why the answer does not. At the same time, he said the question was, what do you call, Purusha come from? Does it come from Prakriti? That is the question. So there was another. If you see the question there, it doesn't stop merely asking. It doesn't merely ask that where did Purusha come from? He said, does it come from Prakriti? The question was wrong, because Prakriti and Purusha are said to be different in the beginning itself. We already told that. So I told then I wanted to explain to him. I wanted to explain to him that Purusha is independent, completely independent. It has got nothing to do with space or anything whatsoever. Unfortunately, our way of thinking, the way of thinking, I mean modern thinking, the default thinking is that everything should come someplace. I mean, making sense. Everything should come from someplace. Whereas Purusha does not belong to Prakriti at all. So it is not possible to answer this question, where did Purusha come from? Because Purusha came from nowhere. It is there all the time. It is there all the time. It is non-changing. See, in the Bhagavad Gita, it is explained like this. See, during our childhood, there are lots of different kinds of chitta vrittis, or childish activities are there. That is overseen by non-changing Purusha. When you become an adult, the type of activities that the main mind goes through are different. But the same Purusha is observing that. And then when the old age comes, another set of what you call activities go on in the mind, chitta vrittis are. That is also seen by the same Purusha. So the Purusha does not undergo any change, whereas the chitta vrittis keep on changing depending upon the stage of life we are in. Again, in what you call another Upanishad called Mandukya Karika, they say the consciousness that is observing whatever goes on in the waking stage is the one that observes everything that goes on in the dream stage. So the thing is, when there is a dream, the dream is not by the waking stage person, but by the non-changing consciousness. So when I say I have got a dream, see, when I have the dream, I'm completely shut off. There is a temporary paralysis of all the motor activities. And then the dream, there is another, what you call, entity, which is shown as the real me. I'm 86 years old. I have a dream and I'm 18 years old. So how can an 86-year-old have a dream of a 16-year-old without objecting? So these are all compartmentalized. You are making sense. So which is the one which is common in all these things? That is the Purusha. So by these different types of argument, they try to show that the non-changing consciousness is entirely different from whatever goes on in the body or in the mind, in the prakritic self. So this is what I try to explain in that particular question.
Okay. Is there interaction? Because the way I initially kind of described my understanding was that it is the observation of Purusha that activates Prakriti. And is there any other kind of interaction between Purusha and Prakriti, or is it just that Purusha is simply just observing?
Yes, according to Sankhya, according to yoga, Purusha is just pure consciousness.
Okay.
Supposing at this particular moment, I'm answering your question, right? The Purusha is merely observing that. After some time, so I will be doing some other activity, the Purusha is like, sometimes I'm very happy, right? The Purusha knows I'm happy, that's all. Or he's experiencing that I'm happy. Then next moment I am not happy, Purusha experience, I am unhappy. Now the whole question what these people are saying is that Purusha is non-changing. It never changes, never undergoes any change. And then this is the subtlest aspect in me. It is subtler even than my buddhi, even my intellect, right? So the correct thing will be for my buddhi to identify with that non-changing consciousness as a self and not the body. Why is it we are doing it? We are doing it for because that's how it started. The whole thing started because of this ignorance about the nature of the self. So the whole purpose of Sankhya, Yoga and Vedanta is to turn the buddhi from thinking body mind complex itself to the real non-changing consciousness as the real self. So that's all their main approach. There is nothing else Purusha does. Purusha does not do anything. It merely observes everything that is going on. That's its nature. It is its nature. What is the essential nature of Purusha or the subject is to be aware of the object. What is the object here? Chittavritti is the object. So all the time the Purusha is aware of the Chittavrittis only. So instead of that, and then Chittavrittis keep on changing, and by and large, these Sankhya yogis and Vedantis say the Chittavrittis are mostly painful. That's their observation. I may not agree with that. But by and large, they say, Mahasadajnata, the reason why Sankhya Karika is written is why do you suffer like this? Why do you suffer like this? Because the real Purusha, the real self, is absolutely non-changing consciousness. It doesn't suffer at all. Why do you think that you are suffering? So, provided the mind, the thinking faculty is able to sit down and think on these lines and understand the non-changing Purusha is the real self and not the, what do you call it, the ego, identification with the body. That is the main purpose of Sankhya. Theoretically, they want to show non-changing Purusha is the consciousness. Once the buddhi is able to accept that, enormous amount of unnecessary association with the body and then suffering like this will go away according to them. It may appeal to a few people. It may not appeal to everybody. So those people for whom this appeals, then they want to, okay. They understand what they say. They read the Yoga Sutra, the Sankhya Gari, they understand what they say. They sit down and think they understand. So these are the two levels of understanding. One is called Paroksha, knowing through somebody else or reading the book. The second is Anumana. I sit down and say, oh yes, I understand that. I understand what they are talking about. I get to. So these two levels of understanding are called, what do you call it? The third level of understanding is my buddhi should be directly able to see the nature of the self. How can it be done? Only in the state of total concentration, which the yogis call it as samadhi. How is it I am able to get into that? That entire procedure of going to samadhi is explained in the, the Yoga Sutras. So these two are companion volumes. The theory is given by Sankhya, which is taken by yogis, and then they take it to the third stage. The first stage and second stage is, first stage and second stage of knowing is, one is directly listening to a teacher, reading books. The second stage is sitting down and analyze. Oh, then I realize, okay, what they say is this logical. That understanding, I'm convinced about it. Once this is done, many people already there, they keep on talking, explaining. But yogis say, no, this is not sufficient. You must directly experience that. Then only the mind will have no desire for any future, but all the desire will go away. For that to take place, you need a strong discipline, a mental discipline that's given by yoga. So that is why yoga developed for people to realize what is explained in Sankhya Karika. Right. And then, they complement each other. If I merely study Yoga Sutras, I may not have a complete understanding of the theory behind it. So I study both the texts. So in this, to make Sankhya Karika intelligible to yoga people, I try to compare most of these things with whatever is contained in the Yoga Sutras.
Yeah. So, if I understand correctly, and I'm sorry, a lot of this is just going to be, I just want to make sure I'm understanding things right. Because you just mentioned samadhi, and samadhi is usually seen as sort of the goal of yoga. And my understanding is samadhi is this sort of absorbed contemplation. And yet in Samkhya, there is kavalya, and kavalya is it fair to say that it is a sort of a knowledge, a kind of gnosis of the Purusha, of the truth? Because I'm still a little unclear as to what might be the difference between samadhi and kavalya, if there is a difference.
Samadhi is a means, kaivalya is
Okay.
a result.
All right.
Okay,
All right.
and samadhi itself is a what you call a mental state, right? Normally, our mind is constantly distracted. Our what you call supposing you take about 5 minutes, 5 minutes the way my mind functions, it surf, what you call surfs from object to object all over. It is called vikshipachitta, they call it. So what yoga tries to do is you try to make the mind focus on one object for the duration of time I want to contemplate upon. You take about 5 minutes. During 5 minutes, for non-yogic people, the mind goes all over the place, right? Different train of thought. You start with one thought, the second thought is different, third thought is different, fourth is different. Fourth has got no connection whatsoever with the first thought. So that's how normally the mind functions. Here, what they try to do is they try to make the mind focus on only one thing. Why? Because very, very difficult for the mind to focus on the nature of Atman, because it is subtle, it is not obvious, right? So for that to take place, they need a very, very concentrated mind. So the meditation process itself is divided into three stages. First stage is called the dharana stage. What they do is, during which time, instead of allowing the mind to go all over the place, they have a focal point. They bring the mind to the same point again. Like, it may be a mantra, it may be a chakra, it may be an icon, whatever. They bring the mind back to the same object again and again. We keep on doing it for a period of time. Then what happens? The mind remains with the same object for the entire duration of your. That stage is called dhyana. And then, when you are able to meditate upon an object for those 5 10 for the duration of time you are contemplating upon, if you even forget your own self, then it's called samadhi. Samadhi is a stage where you not only are completely oblivious to the outside world, you became even oblivious to your own body, and in your mind, only the object that you are contemplating remains in your mind. If that stage is called, that's called samadhi, right? So samadhi is a stage wherein you are able to contemplate. You mean by my buddhi with a total concentration, it is able to understand the true nature of my own self. When that takes place, the mind comes to a stop, and that stage is called kaivalya. Kaivalya is the result, samadhi is the means.
Okay. All right. Thank you for that. That helps. One of the things that, and again, this is, I want to make sure that I'm correct in understanding this, is when we talk about Purusha, and I'm looking for the quote in the from the book. I don't know if I can find it as I want, but it is. I'm just going to phrase this in my poor understanding, but I think that when we talk about Purusha, there's this idea often, or that there's like one Purusha, and that we're recognizing through Kavalya that we are this one Purusha. But my understanding is that there's individual Purushas. It's like these, I always think about it as like these little bubbles, that each of us has this little bubble of Purusha. And I think in terms of kind of comparative terms in difference with, for example, like Advaita Vedanta, where the idea is that the Atman is Brahman and that all the various Atmans are this one thing, that there are not all these individual Brahmans everywhere. But in Samkhya and Yoga, it's not quite the same. Do I have that right?
You are right. You are perfectly right. Yes, I think I mentioned to you that these three philosophies, Sankhya, Yoga, and Vedanta, they form one group, and then they are sibling philosophies, Vedic philosophies, and then their goal is the same, which is Kaivalya or Moksha or Nirvana, whatever you want to call it. But according to Sankhya and Yoga, Sankhya says if you understand the true nature of the self, that is Kaivalya. That's all what you need. Once you know your own true nature of the self, you don't have to bother about other things. You don't have to bother about what is the nature of the self in somebody else, some other person or not. So they say that you concentrate upon. So the first step in all these things to know who really you are, and that is supposed to be what you call the real Purusha. And then practically to be able to achieve this is given by yogi. So these two people, They don't. They say, they argue that, if they say that, each one has got a different lifespan, each one has got a different mental activities, all right. Okay, so some are sattvic, some are rajasic, some are tamasic, right? All so many differences are there. So there should be different, what do you call, different atman should be there. But then Vedanta, especially Advaita Vedanta, they come and say they take one more step, right? The only experience I have all through my life is my chittavritti, nothing else, right? The world I know, the world I know. See, I say that so many things are happening in so many different places. If I'm an astronomer, I will be thinking about the Milky Way and all that. On the other hand, if I'm a microbiologist, I will be thinking about, small cells and all that. If I'm an atomic scientist, I will be th so likewise, my world is limited to what I'm doing, right? Right now, supposing I'm saying, I supposing I say there are 100, there are different people have should have different atmans and all that. That is also part of my thinking only. I do not have any means of understanding what is going on other people. Right at this particular moment, I see the computer in you. I see you in the what do you call, in the monitor talking now. All these things are gone to my head, and then only as a chittavritti I'm able to see that my world is completely limited. I mean, there is nothing. I mean, according to Vedanta, there is nothing like a, what do you call, a world where number of people live. The what do you call, the only experience I have is my chittavritti. Whatever happens to my mind, everything, anything that you say. Supposing you say the world is big, or different philosophies there, all of them come under my own world, my own what do you call, mental world. So if that is the case, there is only one, what do you call, but there is only one, only Purusha. There is only one Purusha, and that Purusha is the Brahman, right? They don't say there are no other Purusha. There is no way of determining whether see, all right, they compare it to a, what you call, a dream stage. In Vedanta, they compare it to a dream stage. In a dream stage, what do you see? Your new universe is created, new world is created, new people are there, all sorts of activities are going on. And then you wake up. Once you wake up, what happened? Everything is gone. Only the pure awareness is there. Whatever was aware of is completely gone, right? So there is no question of asking whether the people that you saw in a dream have a different atman or not. Even the, what you call, the individual that you saw, which was wrongly identified as your own self, the dream self is not you. But still, at that particular, you know what I mean? When I'm having a dream, then number of people are created in the dream, and the mind, what you call, chooses one of them as myself. And then acts along with that. So this is how it is happening in the waking stage also. They say that the non-changing Purusha, the Brahman or Purusha, is observing everything that is going on in my chitta, just like a dream stage. So it is not possible for us to say that other people exist independently, and then they have their own souls. This question cannot be answered. So the only thing I'm aware of, only thing I can identify is my own self. And that, just like the dream world is created by my own Atman, see, similarly, the world I am experiencing is created by the Brahman within me. So they say that Atman and Brahman are one and the same. There is a slight difference between what yogis and Vedanta, yogis and Sankhya say, and the Vedantins say. Vedantins say there is only you. I mean, I don't know whether I'm making myself clear. The whole thing is, there is no other experience. There is no other experience than whatever I'm experiencing. Everything, supposing I say, what you call, supposing somebody says there are, different individuals have got different atmans. That's what the Sankhyas and Yogis say. That is part of my own understanding, my own knowledge, my own world. There's another theory. That's also my own world. So there is no way by which sometimes I think on these lines, right? Right? I have no other experience except whatever is taking place in my mind. I have no other experience. I have no other experience. Right? So
Okay.
that being the case, they say there's only one consciousness, and that one consciousness is Brahman or Atman. That is the view of the Vedantists, right?
Okay.
Not
All right.
that one, what you call, one Brahman went and then divided into hundreds and thousands of people. That's not the way, ultimately this will have to be explained.
Okay. All right. One of the and this kind of gets us there. And this is addressed in the book. But when I first started learning about Samkhya, and its connection to yoga, What I had read was that the main difference is that Samkhya is atheistic, whereas yoga allows for like a personal God. But in the book, it clearly states that Samkhya never claims to be atheistic. And so I'm curious, when we talk about Purusha, is Purusha God? I mean, you had mentioned Brahman Purusha. Is that fair to say, is it incorrect?
No, see, the word God we use as a creator, isn't it? By and large, that's the meaning of the word. God is the one who created this universe. In Sankhya, they said Mula Prakriti is the created the universe, and it has no consciousness. So nature is capable of evolving itself into this entire universe. So they did not feel it necessary to bring the idea of God with respect to creation. So I don't say that Sankhyas were against God or anything. They did not think it was necessary. They were able to explain everything, you know, from Mula Prakriti, everything evolved, and everything will go roll back into Mula Prakriti at the time of resolution. So they didn't find a need to bring in God in this particular case. I mean, my view is we cannot say that. Nowhere have they said that there is no God. They have not said that. They have not said that. Right? If you come to what you call Yoga Sutras, the word Ishvara is used, but Ishvara is not used as a creator. Ishvara is not used as a creator, but the term Ishvara is used to indicate a guru. Worshipping Ishvara, you will be able to get the true knowledge of your own self. Why? Because Ishvara and the individual soul are identical so far as the essential nature is concerned. Only thing the individual Purusha like us, because of the association with the karma, we keep on jumping from one birth to other. But Ishvara has got no such defects in him. That's all the difference between the two. Even in yoga, Ishvara is not considered as God, as a creator. Even in, see, in Sankhya, they did not bring the term Ishvara because Ishvara or God, because God is not, God's function is creation, which is not necessary because creation is already given to Pumula Prakriti. So they have not brought it. They have not clearly said that there is no God. When you come to Yoga Sutra, the Ishvara is used, God is used, but God is not used as a creator, but as a supreme consciousness. That's about all. Ultimately, when you go to Vedanta, again, Brahman is supreme consciousness, right? Though we associate the supreme consciousness with creation and all because of our false understanding of the nature. So, you know, you could see that, they are not against God. At the same time, they did not find it necessary to bring in God to explain whatever philosophy they are explaining.
And I don't necessarily, when I think of God, you know, the first question I always ask is, you know, whenever someone talks about God, I'm like, well, what do you mean by that? Because I don't necessarily assume God as creator. And what comes to my mind, an analogy from Western philosophy is with the sort of the idealism of Bishop George Berkeley, which is that, for Berkeley, everything is occurring within consciousness. That's what we mean by idealism.
Right.
And the question was, his famous phrase was, to be is to perceive is to be is to be perceived. And, the question was, well, what happens if something is not being perceived? It's the old question, if a tree in the forest falls, does it make a sound? Well, one answer is, well, it doesn't unless there's someone there to perceive the sound.
Right.
Berkeley's response was that God perceives all things.
Right.
And so it seems to me that that's a analog to Purusha, that Purusha is just the perceiver.
Right.
It's the consciousness that perceives all things.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I understand that. In Vedanta, again, Brahman is the ultimate consciousness, and everything that is created within is within that extreme consciousness, the what you call Brahman itself. But only thing they say is what is created within that consciousness is only what you call is only an illusion. It is not real, right?
All right.
So, yeah, there are three aspects in every object that we see: a name, a form, and the substance, right? Right. If you see the computer, there is a substance in it. It's got a name. It has got a form. According to the Upanishads, everything that is created in the consciousness itself is made up of only of name and form, no substance in it. Because Brahman has got no capacity to produce any material. It can't produce any material. Just like in our dream, we can produce a dream, but we can't produce substance. When you have a dream, everything appears to have a lot of material, right? You have a lion that runs, there's a tree, all of them have substance, appear to be. But really, there's no substance in it. So, likewise, they say that the entire creation is only an illusion, but it takes place within the Brahman. So if I'm able to say that Brahman and I are one and the same, all the activities that are going on in me, everything in the outside world, as I told you, is taking place only is in my mind as a Chittavarti. And that Chittavarti is taking place in my consciousness, what you call as Brahman and all. So everything is reduced to what you call one consciousness, only one consciousness. And in that one consciousness, that is with which I am now associated. This will apply to everybody else. It will apply to everybody else, right? So each one, it doesn't, I mean, what I'm trying to say is, it doesn't admit that there are a number of other people are there. In my world, I have only my thought process are there. I don't see anything other than that. I mean, however much I may be wanting to say, okay, everything, other people are there. I mean, all of them come to my own mind. It's all in my own world. In my own world, all these things are. These are taking place in my own consciousness, according to Vedanta. It is all taking place in my own consciousness. So, and then they don't have substance, right? Once it comes to my mind, supposing I see the computer in me, according both science and what do you call yoga, everything goes to my brain. The brain is converting everything into an image, and I'm only seeing an image. I means who? The Purusha in me, not Ramaswamy. The Purusha in me is seeing that. Once that is done, then the Vedanta say, right, everything that is taking place, it is taking place only in one consciousness. That consciousness should be called as Brahman. And then there's no substance to it. There's no, because the Chittavritti has got no substance, right? No material in it. Only form and names are there. So yeah. I don't know whether I made it clear.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's difficult to talk about a lot of this because it's, the term that's often used is it's ineffable, that some things are somewhat indescribable, but we try to. And sometimes it's just a matter of our language. It's like when, for example, it's like the Purusha in me, but you can't really say that, can you? Because, Purusha doesn't exist in space. So Purusha can't be in anything. It seems to be
No,
this sort of,
no,
it's.
in yoga and yeah, in yoga and in yoga and what do you call Sankhya, Purusha is distinct. But in Vedanta, if it is called Brahman, then everything takes place within the Brahman only. Within the Brahman only, it is taking place. And as I mentioned to you, all right. See, if you really look at the Yoga Sutras, well, as I told you, that all our life is that I am the subject, the outside world is the object. Now he says, all right. The subject is non-changing pure consciousness, not Ramaswamy. And then the object is not the outside, it's only Chittavarti. So he reduced everything, and Chittavarti has got no substance. I
So
don't see the
everything.
outside world. I don't see the outside world at all. I don't see. I means what my guru, my Purusha does not see. Right? I also, the Ramaswamy also belongs to the Prakriti. So how do I know me? How does my Purusha understand me? Because what you call my the new numerous nerves in me send impressions to my brain. My brain is able to reconvert my whole body into another image. That's what I see. That's what I experience. So if that is the case, right? If that is the case, then absolutely what Vedanta says becomes perfectly correct. Right? There is no real creation. There is absolutely no real creation in the sense what there is no substance. There are forms created, there are names created. That's why in the Upanishads say Nama Rupe Vyakaran. The entire creation is only made up of name and form. There's no substance to it. But when we see substance, all right, that's perfectly all right. But then we have got to step to take one more step. All right, how do you see the outside object? How do you see the object outside? Both, what do you call, both science and what do you call, yoga and Sankhya say that whatever we, even though the outside objects may be real or not, what we see is only an impression, only a projection of the mind. Because everything is converted into a projection of the mind. And then so Patanjali takes the whole thing is the subject is Purusha and the object is Chittavarti, and the subject is not Ramaswamy and the outside world is not the what do you call, is not the object. That's the biggest what do you call, biggest what shall I say, biggest revelation of Yoga Sutras. That reduces subject and object. Ramaswamy subject, outside world object is reduced to Purusha is the subject, Chittavarti is the object. Now I have got to deal only with the Chittavarti hereafter. Once I'm convinced about it, and then as I told you, both science and the Yoga Sutras say we don't see the objects of the outside world per se. The eyes don't see the objects per se. Everything goes to the brain, and then we just put how do we see? Just ask the question in AI or Google, it will say we don't see the objects directly. We only the information goes to the brain, it is reconverted, and then it is projected within the mind, into what you call in the visual cortex. So if I'm able to pay more attention to it, then the Yoga Sutras, Sankhya, and Vedanta become more and more, what you call, more and more what you call, accessible. And also you'll start realizing that that is the truth. That is the truth.
It's fascinating, and I always find value in yoga and Samkhya, and I love how it is different from a lot of the Western philosophies, but I think it resolves a lot of questions from Western philosophy, like that ongoing mind-body problem, in a sense. But it takes us to just this observer. This it's the pure. So Purusha is like the pure, not just pure consciousness, but pure subject.
Yeah, pure subject, all right. Actually, I mean, the only reason why I wanted to write this particular book was, okay, I try to make it as accessible as possible, And then my understanding of the whole philosophy, Sankhya, Yoga, and Vedanta, they are speaking the truth, right? They speak the truth, right? Only thing is because of the language or the way we normally go about thinking. This, and then biggest what you call contribution that is made about this is by Yoga Sutras. The subject is the non-changing consciousness, the object is Chittavarti. And then even if you go according to science, we don't see objects per se. Everything is goes to the mind, and then mind is converting everything in, and then it is a whole thing is projected in mental space. Right? So if you are able to accept, then the next questions can be asked. They don't, science does not go beyond that. These people, these Sankhyas, yogis, and Vedantas go beyond that, right? They go beyond that. So if you are able to accept, you accept. That is why in the book I tried to compare it with the what you call what science also says, right? Because people are will be more convinced if we, science says it, because it's also logical. What science says is logical. And what I want to say is what Sankhyas, yogi, and Vedantas say also very, very logical.
And you address the logic in the book too. I recall that, and I think it's important.
I don't know.
Some.
Just a minute. I don't see you at all.
I don't know. I'm still here. I still see you and hear you.
Okay, right. Okay, then.
But what I was saying is that right now in Western philosophy and Western science too, the big question is consciousness and, what is it, where, things like that. And I always find that the Indian philosophies, and I always make an appeal to Samkhya and yoga, that we need to bring them into the conversation because they have something very important to say that, they've been exploring, the Indian gurus and philosophers have been exploring consciousness for thousands of years now. And we in the West, we're just now starting to ask the question. And instead of looking at, brain scans and whatnot, I always want to say, just sit down and meditate for a little bit. Maybe that's the place we need to begin, and in our own experiences.
My feeling is that, you know, even scientists are, they got an open mind. They must try to find out what these Sankhyas and the yogis and Vedantists have to say, right? Rather than merely saying, you know, no. After all, the only thing is, if we can explain Sankhya, Yoga and Vedanta in a more logical way, I think we got a good meeting ground, right? Unfortunately, most of the old texts were written in the old language, and then many of the ideas were taken for granted. Now we got to explain everything; otherwise, you know, modern scientific mind will not accept that. So the modern philosophers, right, yogis or Vedantas, will have to come down and then try to explain it in a more logical way, rather than merely saying that that's what the old texts say. And it is possible. If it is true, it should be possible to explain in a logical way. That's what I try to do in the book. That's what I try to do in the book, right? Try to make it as reasonable or logical as possible. So that's why sometimes you find that I've used examples from modern, you know, our day-to-day experiences, even though that may not be exactly what you find in the old text, right? If you can't merely rely upon old text, then in that case, we'll be just giving lectures and lectures and all that. They've got to explain everything in so that the modern mind can understand to the extent possible.
Well, I think that you did a remarkable job with the book, and I'm very grateful for it. I have a deep abiding interest in Indian religion and philosophy, and I've read and taught the Yoga Sutras, and I find the Samkhya Karika that you've done here an invaluable addition to our understanding of what is a very complex system that is not very well known in the West.
Yes.
So I thank you for that. And I think that it's the way you presented the book, it's just remarkable, especially with the Sanskrit. You know, Sanskrit is a very underappreciated language, I think, because it allows for so much nuance that we miss in a lot of our Western languages, even though we're grounded in Sanskrit. But I know that we are pretty much out of time, but let me ask you the final questions. What do you have coming up next? What are you going to be working on?
No, I intend writing on one more book. I think I'm halfway through. One is on Bhagavad Gita for yoga students. Another one is Yoga Sutras for yoga students, actually. My whole idea is to make, the yoga practitioners get more and more interested in the philosophical aspects of it, so that they get a more complete picture of the whole system, right? So not only physical exercise is good, pranayama is good, but also understanding the various nagging questions in our mind, which we don't even ask. So, slowly people can get interested more. These philosophies are easily, what shall you say, it's for everybody. You know, every human being can find something useful in these philosophies, right? Even though it was written in the old Vedas, you know, I think it is beyond, there is no religious aspect or religion or anything in it. It's only logical, reasonable, arguments are there. So that's what I'm trying to do. And then the next, I'm also doing a program, in September at Salt Lake City, Utah. I will be teaching about 60 hours of asanas as per the Vinyasa Krama system, and 20 hours for Sankhya Karika, word by word, and another 20 hours for Yoga Sutras. So these are the programs I'm thinking. I'm now in India. I'm planning to come to US in August and then do some programs.
Okay. Do you have a web page for where people can go to keep track of your programs and your upcoming books?
Yeah. I have a website, vinyasakrama.com. Vinyasa. I can probably email to you these particulars if it is okay with you.
Okay, yeah, please. And what I'll do is I'll put the website and links for the book in the show notes in the video description. So I would encourage anyone who practices yoga, like you said, yoga is not just, the way I phrase it is, yoga is not just about getting bendy or being in shape. There's so much more to it than the physical aspect that so many in the Western world kind of think of, that there is this deep abiding philosophy to it. And I am very appreciative of your efforts to bring that philosophy out, so that more people can know about it, because it is incredibly important, I think. So
Okay.
I just want to, please go ahead.
Before we close, I just wanted to thank you for this opportunity. And one thing is, thank you for these really probing questions. I've just been wanting to talk on these lines. And thank you so much for asking these wonderful questions. Thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, it was an awesome opportunity for me to ask someone who knows these questions, because my approach is, I want to understand. And so I am so grateful for the time I had with you today and the ability to ask you these questions. So, very deep thank you for me.
Thank
So,
you. Thank you very much.
and that's a wrap on episode 199 of Rebel Spirit Radio. Thank you so much for listening or watching if you're part of my YouTube audience. As always, if you enjoyed this episode, please hit that like button if you're watching on YouTube, and don't forget to subscribe to the channel and click that notification bell. You can also follow Rebel Spirit Radio on whatever audio platform you use for listening to podcasts. Right now, I'm nearing 20,000 downloads on the audio platforms, yet I only have 12 followers, and one of those is me. It only takes a second to like, follow, or subscribe, and it is totally free, and it really does help. Putting together this podcast is a labor of love, and I do love it. I put a lot of effort and time into each episode, so if you find value in the conversations I provide here, I hope you can find it in your heart to send a little love my way. With more subscriptions and followers, I could possibly get some sponsorship, and honestly, having some funds come my way to help with equipment, hosting, and other necessary subscriptions would be really helpful. You can also help by joining my Patreon at patreon.com/rebelspirit. The link is also in the episode description. You can also buy a super thanks on YouTube to help support my work. As I always say, I'm here in the Front Range now doing missionary work in regards to religion, spirituality, and ecology, consciousness, the esoteric, and how all of this can help us heal humanity's sacred relationship with the living earth. So if you feel moved by the rebel spirit, and I sure hope that you do, then please, by all means, help me in my efforts to share the good news. I'm Nick Mather, and you've been listening to or watching Rebel Spirit Radio. Until next time, may you be in peace, may you flourish in all possible ways, and may you continue to nurture your rebel spirit.